You're talking about the Pandavas? The Pandavas, when they were... Their father died. Their father died when they were just about 10, 11, 12 years old. And for the two twins, Nakula and Sahadeva, their mother died. And I was saying how they came... They actually grew up way up in the mountains, like 10, 11, 12,000 feet up in the mountains in a place called Shatasringa, which means 100 peaks. Cien picos, in Spanish. And... So imagine what it's like to be, let's say those of you who are 10, 11, or 12, imagine what it's like to be that age and suddenly your father dies, your mother, one of your mothers passed away, and you've grown up as a yogi way up in the mountains, suddenly you come down to this big political city with all kinds of armies, political intrigue. Hey, Ricky.
Hey.
And so you come down and... And then you find out someone's trying to kill you. The Pandavas were practically just children. In fact, they're described in the Bhagavatam when they came down from the mountains, they were described as Bala, which means children. They weren't even like teenagers or anything. So it's a very traumatic thing. I mean, even in terms of modern psychology, it's very, very disturbing. And according to the culture they lived in, Dhritarashtra was supposed to be their father because he was their uncle. They're just kids. Their father suddenly died. And so their uncle was supposed to be like their father. And then you find out your uncle, who's now your father, is trying to kill you. So it's like a very difficult situation. So they were just with their mother, Kunti, and they grew up in that constant danger. In fact... Duryodhana did try. He tried to kill Bhima. Duryodhana is very envious of Bhima. They had a problem their whole life. Yes.
Why was your uncle trying to kill me?
Well, Dhritarashtra was. He wasn't like directly. How should I put it? Why? Because he wanted his son to be king. I mean, that's the short answer. He wanted his son Duryodhana to be king. Little, you know, sweet little Duryodhana. And it shows that. If you study what life was like if you were alive back then during the Vedic times, it wasn't absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy means the king can do whatever he likes. Like there's no law, there's no constitution. The king doesn't like you, your history. You can't say, I have my rights. There's no courts, there's no nothing. And actually, Vedic culture wasn't like that. In Vedic culture, it was what's called constitutional monarchy. There was actually, it's like in America, we have a constitution, there's laws. There were actually laws back then. The laws were called dharma. I mean, dharma also means, among other things, means law. So, for example, when Dhritarashtra sent the Pandavas off to die in the house of Lak, that house they burned down, people suspected what he was doing. And so, when the Pandavas escaped the house of Lak, everyone thought they'd died. And so the people just went out on the streets and began insulting the king. It wasn't like some movie you may have seen where if you say one word against the king, you get your head chopped off. It wasn't like that. People actually could go out in public and just criticize the king, which they did sometimes. So the reason I bring this up is because Dhritarashtra couldn't just... I mean, not that he wanted to kill them. It's just like, well, we'll do what we have to do. If it comes to that, I guess we'll have to do it. But he was determined to have his son be king. And he couldn't just openly kill the Pandavas because the people wouldn't accept it. So there was actually, as I said, it wasn't an absolute monarchy where the king could do anything. There were actually certain rules and principles. And at some point, for example, when the Kurus, Duryodhana's father, were plotting, they even would discuss that, well, we can't do this because the people won't accept it. So that's the kind of political culture they had back then. So they had to be careful how they did it. Duryodhana tried to kill Bhima a few times, like with poison snakes and things that never worked. Poison food and then snakes. But anyway, the fact that when Duryodhana arranged for his father to send the Pandavas to... what's in that city? Varnavata. Well, the house of Lak. You know what the house of Lak was? You know what Lak is?
Well,
lacquer. It's like...
They also have like ghee and other flammable things. They also have like ghee in
it. Yeah, just, it's everything that would burn. But the interesting thing is they had to do it sort of secretly because they didn't want people to find out, which shows that kings didn't have absolute power. They were actually afraid of public opinion. If public opinion turned against them, even if the army might turn against them, they'd be in trouble. So the Pandavas were also very popular. People liked them. It's mentioned in the Mahabharata that when they went to Varnavata, they visited the houses of all kinds of people. They didn't just hang out with the Kshatriyas. They actually went to the Shudras. They went to the... Like, it's funny, there was one so-called guru that came to some devotee's house from India, some devotee's house here in the area, and he found out that those always have a dog, an evil dog, which lives in, doesn't even live in their house. The dog lives outside their house, and so that he wouldn't take food there because they had a dog in their yard. Whereas the Pandavas, when they went to Varnavata, they were princes. They actually went to everyone, they visited different people's homes, even Shudras and Vaishyas, visited their homes, introduced themselves. They were very, very popular. People really liked them. But they actually grew up as yogis. So they were big, powerful guys, but they grew up as yogis and Brahmins, so when they escaped that burning house and they went incognito, no one knew they were still alive, they disguised themselves as Brahmins. It's like, let's say you come from some foreign country, like if someone, let's say some devotee comes from Serbia or something and speaks Serbian. I mean, most people in America do not speak Serbian. So if you come from Serbia and you wanted to like tell a secret to someone from Serbia, you could speak Serbian, no one around you would understand what you were saying. So the Pandavas, when they had to be secretive, they disguised themselves as Brahmins. And the reason they disguised themselves as Brahmins is because, in a sense, they were Brahmins. They actually knew how to do that. They grew up that way. They knew like exactly how to wear the clothes. They knew how to walk and talk. They knew they could perfectly imitate a Brahmin because they grew up that way. So they disguise themselves as Brahmins, and they're still young. They're just teenagers. When they escape the house of Lakh, they're practically still teenagers. And they're, you know, running for their lives. Duryodhana has this huge army behind him. Imagine what it's like. If you live in some totalitarian country, some country with a bad king, and there's like a whole army looking for you, and there's spies everywhere. Because we know that, Chanakya Pandit mentions it, in the Vedic culture they had lots of spies. Because it's like the FBI, CIA, because intelligence. When you're ruling, the kings, they always wanted to know, like, what's going on, what are people really thinking, and so they had spies. They sent spies all over the place. So imagine if you're the Pandavas, like, you could just stop in some little village for water, and anyone could be a spy. Anyone could be an agent of Duryodhana. You don't know who you can trust, who you can talk to. Another thing is, the Pandavas, it was kind of a little hard to disguise themselves because they had like these, they were like these big Kshatriya bodies, so they wore kind of these Jedi Knight robes. You know, they wore these different robes to disguise the fact they had these huge arms. And so imagine, it's really amazing, just these five brothers and their mother just wandering around trying to, and you know, probably what they did is they probably traveled by night, hid during the day, and they finally sort of got. If you look at India back then, a map of India. Do we have a map of India here? Nope, we have not got a map of India. Anyway, if you look at a map of India, there were the kingdoms. It's like when European countries, England and France, and had all kinds of colonies. Spain. I mean, England's actually a small island, but they had colonies all over the world. France is not that big. So if you look at the actual, like, the historical Kuru land, it's not, I wish I had a map of India, I could show you exactly what the Kuru land was, the Panchalas, all these different kingdoms. The what? Gujarat, Prabhupada, the Guru Kuli in Haran. Can I erase that?
Yeah.
Will anyone be offended? Will anyone start crying? No? If I erase. See, if you grow up and you become an ISKCON guru, you can have people erase the board for you. You get all kinds of perks. Never have to erase your own board again.
Yeah. I just wanted to get a few seconds on stage time.
You want to dance? So,
here goes nothing. I try to do a map of India. Oh, God. Anyway, it's sort of like that. And, let's see. I mean, it was all one before. Nowadays, it's like, you know, this might be Gujarat here, and then Bombay's down here, and Delhi's here. What is now Delhi was actually Indraprastha, the kingdom of the Pandavas. Because these are the mountains up here, the Himalayan mountains. You see, those are perfect drawings of mountains.
These are trees.
What's that?
Trees. These are little trees up. And the deer running around.
I know. These are probably the most realistic drawings of mountains you've ever seen in your life. So what happens basically is that it snows a lot up in the mountains. In fact, the word Himalaya, the Himalayan mountains, the word Hima in Sanskrit means snow or ice or cold. And Alaya means a place. So Himalaya literally means the place of snow or the place of cold and ice. So now what happens is, guess what? The snow melts. And when the snow melts, there's actually what's called a continental divide. Just like in America, over by New Mexico, what it means is, if you look at America, you know, you have the ocean and the land and the coast, guess what, is sea level. And then the land comes up a bit, and at a certain point, you get what you call the continental divide, which means that all the water, like the snow that melts, all the water that runs on the west side of the continental divide. I'll show you in America. Well, you get that little map.
Colorado.
What?
Isn't Colorado also?
Yeah. So where the divide is, all the water that runs on the west side just flows out to the west, on the east side to the east. So there's also a continental or subcontinental divide in India. So all this snow and ice and all this water up there, some of it runs this way. Like, for example, you get the Sindhu River. So the people on the Persians on this side pronounced it Hindu. That's where the word Hindu comes from. And because the water ran this way. But also a lot of the water up in the mountains runs the other way. So, for example, you get this, which is the Jamuna River. And then another place, you get another river coming down here, which is the Ganges River. So on the Jamuna, Delhi is on the Jamuna. And on the Jamuna here was Indraprastha, the land given to the Pandavas. Here was Hastinapur on the Ganges. And so all this stuff here, up here was Kurukshetra. So all this land here, basically this land here was historically the land of the Kurus. Then this land, well, let's say about like that. Then when you come south of the Kurus, it was Panchala, you know, Draupadi, Drupal, and all that. So Panchala is the south, and then down here, the Jamuna comes down like this, and you have Mathura and Vrindavan. So they're all neighbors. Like the Yadus were in Mathura, the Panchalas, Drupada and Draupadi were in Panchala. Here were the Kurus, the Pandavas. They were actually all neighbors. There were these kingdoms that weren't that large, but they had a lot of power in the world. The kingdom itself wasn't geographically that large. Yes?
Varanavata.
It's a good question. It might have been up the hill somewhere. So where were we? The Pandavas fleeing. So basically, I know the point. So the Pandavas basically had to get out of the Kuru land because, for example, if the Pandavas could get to Panchala or down to the Yadu lands or just other kingdoms around here, then even though there might be Kuru spies, there wouldn't be a Kuru army. Basically, the Kuru army would not be operating outside the Kuru land. And so they needed to. That's why the Mahabharata, they run for it. They run at night. They actually planned their escape. They planned to escape at night, so no one could see them, and they just kept going until they got past the border.
Did they go to Panchala?
They went to Ekachakra, and it was not in Panchala. It was actually some minor kingdom. We had to figure out exactly where that was, Ekachakra. There's different theories about where it was, but it was sort of a small kingdom with an incompetent king. The king was sort of like a loser, and that's why they had trouble with that demon. What was that, Rakshasa? Bhaka. That Rakshasa that Bhima killed there. But that's what they had to do. They had to get past the border and get out of the Kuru land, get away from the Kuru army.
What's the word for a spy in Sanskrit?
Chara. Literally means a mover, like someone that moves around. Chara.
Kshetra was up with the Himalayas?
Well, my map kind of got squashed. I'm going to do this again. Okay, take two. Actually, I'm erasing the board myself.
Uh-oh.
I'm exhibiting my humility. I wish we had a map of India. I could show you exactly where these places were. Okay, try it again. Okay, if this is maybe Delhi, Indraprastha, and here would be Hastinapur, and Kurukshetra would be there. What'd you ask about?
Kurukshetra.
Yeah, Kurukshetra's up here. And then here would be Mathura, where the Yadus were, Kangsa.
And then mountains.
Mountains?
Yeah.
They
grew wings.
Beyond.
They grew wings, yeah, and flew away.
Where is the canal of Virata?
Where's Rishikesh?
Start throwing money at me and I'll show you. Let's see. Okay, now if you know, like, let's say here's Mathura and Vrindavan, if you've ever been to India, and then from Vrindavan here, if you go a little bit over, you come to Jaipur, where everyone goes. So from here's Jaipur, then you go up a little bit this way. This was the kingdom of Virat. That's where the Pandavas went incognito. And of course, out here is Dwarka, out in the sea. So Krishna, he took his the Yadus from Mathura and he moved them out to Dwarka. We have to actually, we're working on the Mahabharata, and it's really amazing. You have to sort of think like you're there back then, what it would have been like to be a Pandava, or Kunti, or Draupadi, what it was actually like to be these people, to go through all these adventures with Krishna. So do you have any questions about these stories? Oh, Hrishikesh. Hrishikesh is just like above Hastinapur there? Or above?
Above Kurukshetra.
Yeah, and a little bit to the east.
Okay.
The mountains, visualize the mountains.
There's a question over there.
Laura?
Yes.
Hey, so back then, it was, according to the authorities, that a world empire. So do we have any information on exactly, maybe not exactly, but general, how that was so? Because,
well, first of all,
most of the story is on North India, right?
Yeah.
So then we don't really have so much.
As far as world empire, there are different types of empires. If you're thinking like the Roman Empire, the Roman Emperor had, there were different kinds of political relationships with the different. Do you have a world map here?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Well, never mind. We have got one.
So you could help people get maps, too.
What?
You could help people get maps.
There
you go. Map. Four, getting water. Slowly getting water.
There you go. That's right. The living map. Okay, let's see. Pointer. Okay, here's Italy. This little thing sticking out there, that's Italy. You see back there? Oh, okay. Here, why don't we... This is Italy right here. This thing right here. Now, basically, the Roman Empire was around the Mediterranean Sea. It was basically a Mediterranean Empire, and also went up a little bit away from the sea. So the Romans had different kinds of political relationships with the countries in the empire. For example, if you look at Israel around the time of Jesus, Israel here is in the east end of the Mediterranean, right there. So... The Roman Empire, and to understand what empire meant in ancient India in the Vedic times, I think you can look at the Roman Empire, it gives you an idea. The Romans had what they called client kings. In other words, let's say you're a Roman emperor, and you just conquered a country like Israel, which they did, and it's a mess because they speak a different language, they have a different religion, they got all kinds of strange customs, and it's just a mess to deal with it. You've got all these different countries, and each one has their own culture. So rather than have to deal with this mess, it's much easier just to find someone in that country who's a local person, who the people will accept. That person becomes the king, and just sends you money, just sends you tribute or taxes. That way,
no mass, you just deposit checks every month. Because in a sense, that's what empire was about. It was about control, it was about riches.
No corruption.
What?
No corruption.
Not corruption? Well, it depends. It depends on who the emperor was, depends on what the circumstances were. But the Romans, like, there's this funny scene from this Monty Python movie where in Israel the people are kind of getting rebellious and they say, what did the Romans ever do for us? And someone says, well, they did build a lot of good roads. Well, besides that, what did the Romans ever do for us? Well, they did provide a system of law and order. Well, never mind that. What else did they do for us? Well, they did provide...
The aqueduct.
They go through this long list of... So, for example, take the state of Florida. I mean, the state of Florida could say, we shouldn't be part of America, we should be independent. But that's just the way it is. A smaller state is part of a bigger state. If you say you're against empire, like nowadays in Hollywood movies, empires are always bad. Like the evil empire, the Empire Strikes Back. In Star Wars, the empire is bad. In basically every movie you ever see, the emperors are always bad. The good guys, the Democrats, the emperors are bad. But look at America. I mean, America's an empire. Apart from American foreign policy, look at all the states. I mean, what right does a government in Washington have to tell people in Florida what the law is, or in Rhode Island, or in California? Florida's an empire, because in Florida there's so many counties, there's Lachlan County, this county, that county. So what right does someone in Tallahassee have to tell someone in Lachlan County what to do? So it's interesting because you have like this modern mythology in which empires are always bad. And, so you always have, like, in every movie you ever see, the emperor's always the bad guys. Isn't it? But what is intrinsically, what is automatically evil about an empire? It depends on whether it's a good emperor or a bad emperor. Anyway, getting back, so if you look at, like, the Pandavas, after they did the Rajasuya sacrifice, and Yudhisthira became the emperor, so what did it mean to be an emperor? It didn't mean that Yudhisthira traveled around all the other kingdoms and managed every other kingdom. That's not what it meant. There's no description anywhere in the Mahabharata that Yudhisthira ever went to Panchala or to Shurasena or to any other kingdom and just started ruling it. What it did mean, at least in the Rajasuya sacrifices, they pay certain tribute. They bring certain... But in return for that, it's not just corruption, because they were paying tribute, they were paying money to the emperor, but in return for that, there was actually what you might call international peace. So that the way the system worked is if some, let's say, nasty king started kicking around his neighbor, then the emperor would come and stop it. So you got protection. You got protection, there was peace, there was law and order, and so on. So the relationship between, like what did it mean for Yudhisthira to be the emperor, basically it just meant that other kings would recognize him as the king of kings, and there would be a central treasury, and he would be responsible to keep peace in the land. That's basically that.
So is Krishna consciousness, how are we supposed to progress politically? Do we have any...
Oh my God, if we could just not overeat, that would be a big problem. As far as politically, I don't know if we're supposed to, like, totally redo the political system in America or other countries. I suppose people become Krishna conscious, they'll elect, well, better leaders than they have now.
So are there any real... Kshatriyas or Brahmanas left, or are we just actually all Shudras here? And in terms of Kali Yuga progressing back then, there was much more of a division. And
well, why? If you say everyone's a Shudra, the Gita means someone that can't work for themselves. They have to be hired by someone else. A lot of people don't work independently.
Right.
So I don't see how you'd say that everyone's a Shudra.
Well, actually, nowadays it's like instead of Brahmanas, there's like school teachers. And those other teachers.
They're priests.
They're
priests also.
Yeah, priests.
But even back in the time of the Mahabharata, some of the Brahmins weren't the most spiritual people in the world. I mean, for example, Jarasandha. You all know Jarasandha. You all don't know Jarasandha. Jarasandha was an evil king that Bhima killed, tore in half. How many people here have heard of Jarasandha? Huh. So.
You.
What?
You.
Very clever. So, Jarasandha was this evil king that actually arrested or kidnapped all these Yadu kings. He was going to kill them alive and offer them as a sacrifice to Kali. And then Krishna came and saved all the Yadu kings. But the point is that Jarasandha had all his Brahmins. He had all these hired Brahmins that would, you know, do sacrifice for him. So there are lots of Brahmins we see in the Mahabharata who are not exactly spiritual people.
Wasn't Ravana a Brahmin?
So it's not the fact that Brahmins, I mean, throughout history, there are a lot of Brahmins who were just like sort of ritual priests, or you know, they weren't always spiritual people. We're supposed to tell stories of, right? You're asking questions, but these young people they want stories. And just know that you are causing emotional pain to the young people here.
The story of Kurukshetra, when Krishna goes in the chariot and meets everyone from Vrindavan, goes out to see him.
Then who?
When Krishna
is on the chariot.
They go to, you know, that's with the Rath Yatra, the original Rath Yatra, right, with Krishna. He went from Dwarka, what would you call it, north?
Did he go from Dwarka to Hastinapur?
Didn't he go to Kurukshetra and the gopis went up to meet up with him?
Yeah. Because Kurukshetra was a holy place. People would go there. People nowadays go to Vrindavan, for example, from all over the world. Yes. Any other questions? And the kids, if you ask a question about a story, then we'll talk about stories. You have to jump in and ask a story question. This is your chance. Otherwise, we will bore you. You'll just be stuck there in your seats. Embarrassed to leave, but suffering here.
Well, could you do a Himalayan story? Like, you know, with mountains and stuff.
Diagrams.
Diagrams?
You want to see some of those fantastic drawings of mountains again?
Yeah.
Hey! My drawings of mountains are actually, I mean, an ordinary person would think they're photographs. Well, one thing is, it gets really cold up there. It gets really, really cold. It's not Florida.
Is it?
No, the Himalayan mountains are not Florida. Contrary to what you've believed all your life, the Himalayan mountains are not Florida. So, Jonathan, you can help me with crowd control because you're a school teacher. Well, when the yogis would go up there, when the Pandavas lived there, it's very, very cold. And during the winter, it gets completely frozen. You can't leave. No one can go in. No one can go out. It's just all snow and ice. It'd be interesting to see what they ate up there. And they must have some system of getting food, yes?
There's people live there?
Nowadays? Some people, not many.
Like yogis?
Hmm? Like, yeah, yogis in the summer. In the summer people go there. But in the winter, it's very, very difficult. Actually, the roads are all, even today, with modern technology, the roads are closed in the winter. You can't go there.
Why was it better for yogis to go into the mountains?
Well, because they wanted to get away from everybody. They wouldn't get any calls on their cell phones. It's like if you're... I know even myself, like so many people who are just leaders in ISKCON, our little ISKCON, people are always calling you on the phone, writing you letters, coming to see you. And so if you really want to get away from it all, they went to the mountains because people wouldn't go there. The simple reason, why wouldn't people in general just live in mountains?
Can't they just go to the desert?
Skiing.
They could. What's that?
Skiing,
right. Because people in the old days, I mean, there were no factories, there was no industry. People basically lived on agriculture. And even things like if you wanted to make clothes, or baskets or weapons. I mean, they would make it out of natural things. And so therefore, everyone lived off the land. And so you go up in the mountains, it's very hard to plow. There's a lot of stones up there. The land's not level. It's very hard to farm way up in the mountains. You know, it's freezing cold in the winter. So really, farmers don't go into the mountains. They just don't go there because it's too difficult. So therefore, I mean, the city, you don't have cities up there. So people would go to the mountains to get away from everyone, for to get away and be alone.
What would they eat?
That's a good question. They would eat, well, a lot of raw foods, roots, really tasty stuff, like roots and sometimes leaves. And I suppose some people would bring them grains, maybe from down the valley. Some people might bring them food. Or they might dry fruits. They didn't eat that much. I mean, they were yogis. They actually didn't eat very much. Like Dhruva Maharaj, when he was doing his yoga practice, he ate very, very, very little. Very hard life. Freezing cold, you don't eat very much. No parties. I mean, no social life. It's pretty, very, very austere. And the Pandavas grew up like that. They were very innocent. They grew up as yogis in the mountains.
I've
never seen pictures of, or drawings of yogis wearing jackets, so did they ever freeze up there? It's a good question. Well, I guess with the yogic powers, maybe they don't freeze to death,
maybe they do. What? They have, like, powers and stuff, so they don't
freeze. I guess the ones that don't have powers freeze to death.
That's the ones you don't hear about.
Yeah, I guess that's why they don't see pictures of them, because I guess they freeze to death. Pictures of the mountains? You have more and more plant activity. Plant fruit trees on the side of the road. Dig wells.
Erase the board for you.
What's that?
Erase the board for
you. Erase the, exactly. Pious activity. Any other questions about the stories of the Pandavas? Yes.
Can you tell us the story of the Pandavas in the kingdom of Virat when they were incognito?
That was pretty hilarious.
And the different roles they played.
Well, stories, we're being good, we're telling stories.
No, just running around doing stuff. Like.
Okay, kingdom of Virat. As I showed on the map, it's not too far away. Where to go? See the J for Jaipur? A little circle up on top of the J. That's basically kingdom of Virat. There's a king there, he's kind of, it's funny, because his son was his prince, who was sort of, what's the word? Not effeminate. But, you know, when you grow up and you're a prince, and like, you get everything on a silver platter, and you can eat
spoiled.
Whatever you want, do whatever, yeah, spoil it, exactly. There's a funny story where he went out to face the Kuru army and then chickened out. Yudhisthira presented himself as a gambling instructor, wasn't it? Because Yudhisthira had lost a gambling master. After that, he studied and became an expert gambler. So he presented himself as a gambling master. Bhima presented himself as a horse trainer. And Arjun presented himself...
Bhima was a cook.
I'm sorry, he's a cook.
Well, it's the
prince,
the twins, one of them was with the cows,
and
one of
them was with the horses. Oh, okay, we got it right now. Rusty. Yes, Bhima was a cook.
And Arjuna was a
Arjun presented himself as a eunuch. That means a person that has no reproductive organs. And as a teacher for the girls, a girls' dancing teacher. I mean, have you ever seen... Even today, like in universities, male dancing teachers, they're, like, anyways, they haven't changed.
Some of them.
No, you are a rare breed. So... Anyway, and then you said the twins. So they went in there, they had to stay incognito, you know that for a year. The main, one of the main stories is that, what's his name, Kimita? Kimita, the demon? Or Kichika?
Kichika.
Kichika. Kichika was his big bully. He was actually, I think, the brother-in-law of King Bharat, and he was like the minister of the army. He was a military, in charge of the military. He was like a big bully. And he was lusty after Draupadi, who presented herself as a maidservant to the queen. You know? Mm-hmm. And so, we all know that story, how he was kept harassing Draupadi, and then Draupadi basically told the Pandavas, I want him taken down. And so, Yudhishthira was kind of a little philosophical about it. And then Bhishma was like, oh my God, this is going to be so much fun. So what they arranged was that Draupadi told him, okay, I give in, you got me. So then she told him to come to this like this deserted area, this hall in the middle of the night, some room. And so he came there, Kichika came there, and she said she'd be there in the bed. And so when Kichika came there, there was someone in the bed, but it was actually Bhima. Funny story. So Kichika went there and started doing it. Oh my dear, all this stuff, and then Bhima gave him a big kiss. Bhima like was so angry at this guy. He like beat him into a medicine ball, like the balls they use in gyms. Like he beat him so bad, he just like punched his arms and legs into his body, his head. So just on the left, like a big ball. And sort of kicked around the ball for a while, and then Bhima would do things in very decisive ways. Like when Bhima killed the demon Bakka, he wouldn't hurt innocent people, but Bakka the demon in Ekachakra was actually eating alive like innocent people. And so when Bhima went to fight with him, he wrestlers have different holds. Bhima actually was thrashing him, and then at a certain point, Bhima put his knee in the guy's back. We could demonstrate this, someone wants to. So basically, imagine someone lying face down here on the floor, and Bhima put his knees in the demon's back, and then grabbed his legs with one arm and his head with the other arm, and broke him backwards.
Good technique.
Yeah, then the fight was called off. So, and then Bhima just dumped him in front of the city gate. So the next morning, Matt's like everybody getting up, going to work, you know, watching the news, sitting around Starbucks. And so the next morning, when everyone got up, they found right outside the city this huge monster just broken backwards like this. And it really struck fear in everyone, because the demon wasn't just killed, he was killed in this, like, really heavy way. And it said that the Rakshasas, because they were like these barbaric people, they were so terrified by what they saw, that after that they were like real nice, like they'd walk down the street and say, oh, hi, hello, Mr. Johnson. And so they said that Ekachakra became like the one place in the world where a Rakshasa was like really well behaved and very polite.
With their big fangs.
I love the fangs, like Mahabharata, some stories.
Isn't that kind of more like the really monstrous type of demon versus just the regular Asura?
I'll tell you later. Okay. I think they were.
Okay. What does Rakshasa mean?
Rakshasa?
Literally.
Well, Raksha means to protect, like Krishna, Raksha Mam. So Rakshasa could mean, it's funny what the name means.
Like guards or something.
It's funny, like when Bhima married Bidimba. It's funny because some of the demons have this power. The yogis have this power called Kamarupa. You've heard of that? Kamarupa? Kama means desire, rupa means form. You can like take any form you want. Like you can look like anything you want. But it doesn't change your genetic code. So Bidimba, when she wanted to attract Bhima, she changed herself into this very beautiful human girl. But then when they had a kid, it was the same genes. It was still like Rakshasa genes. You know what I mean? It's like you're not very good looking, but you put a lot of makeup on, you're still going to have kind of like homely jeans. So, So Ghatotkacha, the son of Bhima, his name actually means it actually means pot shine.
Was he that really, really tall person?
He's pretty tall.
Like, you know, that giant?
Oh, he's a giant, but Ghata means a pot. You know, like a shiny pot. And Ghatotkacha means like real shiny.
So,
yeah, Potshine, that's his name. He's called Potshine because he was shaved and he was like, he was bald permanently, like I said, no hair in his head was real shiny. So they called him, you know, little Potshine. It's funny because like, we read these books, we're all like real serious and it's always really great, but there's like all this funny stuff. You know, Mr. Potshine, it's really funny stuff.
I don't know if I told the story. I've always been curious about the Nirjala Ekadasi. Under the Nirjala Ekadasi, there's a story on that.
There's always a story.
But is there really a true one, or is it just made up?
I don't know. It's sort of like the whatever platform. Because the real point is that it's just a big austerity. I mean, stories are told, I think, to encourage people. Maybe some of the stories are true, but the real point is that it's an austerity. I've never really been like spontaneously attracted to that kind of thing.
I mean, aren't all ekadasis originally you're supposed to not drink water?
They have an old saying, don't try to be more Catholic than the Pope. And so, ekadasi just means no grains and beans. And then, people always want to make things technical and rituals. They got that, this whole thing about you have to break ekadasi by this time, and this is the exact time, and blah, blah, blah. To me, it makes no sense at all, like this Indian ritual thing, because let's say it's a codicil on a Saturday, and then on Sunday, you have to break a codicil, let's say, after 7 o'clock in the morning. What that means is, I mean, a codicil is only 24 hours, so a codicil doesn't end until 7 in the morning on Sunday. It means it doesn't start until 7 in the morning on Saturday, which means you can stuff your face with grains until 7 o'clock on the codicil day, and then just like, then perform your austerity the rest of the day. So when Prabhupada was here, it was like life was simple. It's like, today's a codicil, tomorrow isn't. Yesterday's not a codicil, today is, tomorrow isn't. And that was the end of it. But some people, they just like, they're not happy unless they like bury everything alive under rules and technical things and rituals. But it's real simple. It's like, one day's a codicil, the next day isn't.
So the Rakshasa, they were a certain breed?
What?
So they were a certain breed?
There are people in the world that are kind of like really sort of low class and barbaric and cannibals. I mean, there are cannibals in the world. For example, in Fiji, up until 100 or 150 years ago, people were cannibals. The native people of Fiji were cannibals, even like 150 years ago.
They are still cannibals in Fiji.
Really?
There was one native Fiji, and he told me that in the middle of the island, you should not go to the middle of the island because there are still like some little tribes who are cannibals.
Wow, that's an impressive civilization. Yeah.
You know, Columbus, if he had sailed just a little bit more to the left or something, he would have landed on an island where it was like full of cannibals.
One Columbus burger to go.
Can you tell us a story about Nrsingadev?
About what?
Nrsingadev.
Now, first of all.
Wait, some highest credit.
What?
Let him erase the board.
Gora. Get your pious.
First,
erase the board. Very good. Be a good boy and I'll give you some poison candy. Yeah.
Excellent.
What's your name? Okay, look. Isn't that ecstatic? Those are my mountains. They're, I mean, an ordinary person would think it was a photograph. It's so incredibly realistic. Now, first of all, regarding the pronunciation of the name, there's a tendency, what we do is, like, it's actually ner, and this is pronounced just like a nerd. Because, I mean, you think of the word nerd, you think of the word nerd, and if you ask the question, what is the vowel in this word? I mean, it looks like E is the vowel. I mean, it's spelled as if E is a vowel. But in terms of phonetics, which is how you actually pronounce things, this is the vowel is actually this letter, the R. So in Sanskrit, there's a vowel R, which we write with an R with a dot under it. And so we actually have this vowel R in English. They just don't know about it and don't have a separate letter for it. But when you don't say nerd. I mean, that would be a nerdy thing to do. Itself, you pronounce this nerd, wouldn't it? Or neared. So the way we actually pronounce this, the vowel is the R, nerd. And that's Nursingadev. Who's not a nerd, but that's how it's pronounced. So, there are the mountains. Where of all the mountains? There goes the nerd. So it's actually nerd, which means nerd is sort of just a short form of Nara, which means a human being or a man. And then Singha means lion. And by the way, this M is not an M. It's called an anuswara. It's a sound like an English word. It's like the English word sing. There's Singha. The dot over the M means it's not really like an M, like a M. It's Nrsingha. But in any case, what devotees tend to do, and this is kind of hilarious, so everyone be prepared to laugh uproariously, is that because this is difficult for Americans to pronounce or Western people to pronounce, they tend to take the R and stick it over here. So you have devotees, what you hear a lot in ISKCON is this. Nrsingha. Nrsingadev. And the reason people pronounce it like that is because the R is difficult, like it's hard to say Nursingha, so they put the R over here. Another example of that is, this thing is kind of weak. In Brazil, they have their own pronunciation problems. You take another thing is, say the word Grihastha. So in Brazil, they tend to pronounce it like this. No, actually, it's worse than that. They tend to say Gihastra. Gihastra. Anyone here from Brazil? So we can give you just a little special humiliation here. Isn't it? You've heard that, Gihastra. So what they do is they take this R and they put it over here. Gihastra. Or Nrsingha.
What does Nrsingha mean?
What?
What is the wrong pronunciation?
Nrsingha means... Actually, if you say Nrsingha, like this, the way people pronounce it, what it means is Lord No Horn. So you have boys all around the world praying to Lord No Horn.
True, he didn't have any horns.
True.
It's the thought that counts.
What's that?
It's the thought that counts.
That's right, it's the thought that counts. So as far as the story of learning Nrsingha, Dave, it's so tempting if you're like you're an ISKCON in the West, mm-hmm. Nrsingha.
Nrsingha. But in Europe they say more Nrsingha.
Nrsingha.
Yeah.
In certain countries.
So do you.
Anyway, Nrsingha, Dave, I took sannyasa, Lord Nrsingha Dev's appearance day with several others. Well, he probably said that Lord Nrsingha would protect us just as he protected the Lord Maharaj. So that was nice. And what do you want to know about Nrsingha Dev? Anything? Well, Hiranyakashi Poo. I mean, it's, you all know the story, don't you?
Yeah.
Randy Gashbu didn't survive the operation. Oh, there's a clock right there. Yes.
You say Nara Hari Rupa, but Nara means people. Hari means
Nara means man. Hari means lion.
Yeah.
I mean, it means other things, but it also means lion.
Hari means lion?
Yeah. It means other things, but it also means lion. Nara Hari. What's that?
So, where is Hare Krishna?
No, as far as Hare Krishna. Back to basic. In Sanskrit, how many of you know any Sanskrit?
You just taught us some.
Yes. Sanskrit, in modern grammatical terms, Sanskrit is called inflected language. What that means is, like in English, if you wanted to say with Krishna, you'd use a separate word, with, and then the word Krishna. But in Sanskrit, if you want to say with Krishna, you don't need the separate word with. You just say Krishnena. So therefore, the sense of with is built into the word Krishnena. Or like, let's say you say unto Krishna, like obeisance unto Krishna. So in English, again, you'd have to use another word, unto Krishna. Yeah, but in Sanskrit, you just say Krishnaya, which means unto Krishna. So there's all these different forms, and similarly, there's a form called the Sambodhana. Anyway, Sambodhana. Sambo. Little Sambo. And it's in English called the Vakutava, like you're directly talking to someone. Like, hey Krishna, Karuna Sindhu. So if you're talking to someone, that's called the Vakutava. You're talking directly to the person. So in Sanskrit, if a masculine word ends in I, or a feminine word like Hari, then the vocative, when you're talking to that person, you would say Hare. Or the feminine word ends in a long A, like Hara or Radha, and you're addressing the person directly, then, you know, it's like Radhe or Hare. So Hari can be the vocative. I mean, Hare is either the vocative of Hari, Hare Krishna, or it's also the vocative of Hara, which is taken as the name of Radharani. So then we say Hare, which is addressing a woman whose name ends in a long A. Simple.
Can you tell us about more mispronunciations?
More what?
Mispronunciations.
Mispronunciations?
No, like
Sanskrit bloopers.
Like, more, no.
Some devotees say Ramayan.
Yeah.
Instead of Ramayana.
Yeah.
Well, Ramayana. I'll tell you what. I don't know if you can get this, but maybe you can get it. Good luck.
Jagannath.
But I'll tell you, like, the main mispronunciation in ISKCON, the Sanskrit.
Jagannath.
What's it?
Jagannath.
Nath. Yes, Nath. The main mispronunciation, I think, in the Hare Krishna movement is mixing up the long and short A, which is like
Narada Muni.
Ah, that's the name.
Narada Muni.
That's like so over the top. This is pronounced in English like and this is pronounced like, well, like they write like you know? So, to give an example in English, for example, consider these two words in English, the word gun and the word gone. If you were writing this like in Sanskrit type letters, this would be gun and this would be long A gone. So if you get these mixed up, it's like saying, yeah, he shot his gun. You know, he came with a big gun. Or if you say that, is he still here? No, he's gone. So devotees constantly mix these up. Gun, gone. Another example is, let's say, imagine these, or consider these two words, fun and fawn. So if you say, well, yeah, we had a lot of fawn. Or if you say, yeah, what a cute little fun. So anyway, long and short A. I could give lots of examples in English. Like, for example, the name Ron, as opposed to the word run. Like, his name is Ronald, but his friends call him Run. Or, like, let's go Ronning. So they always constantly do this. It's almost like they have some built-in chip
So they always did everything backwards?
Well, I'll give you a great example. One example, a very common word in Sanskrit that devotees in ISKCON, practically all the devotees in ISKCON, even the Indians by association with us, where they get every vowel in the word wrong. And that is, Gaur, as we say, Purnim. The word is actually Purnima. So in terms of vowel lengths, it's actually long, short, long, and devotees change it into short, long, short.
So what is it?
Gaur Pur, they say Gaur Purnim. Actually, they just cut this one off entirely. It's Purnima. When it comes like the word Purnam, like in the beginning of the Isha Upanishad, Purna means full, so Purnima is the full moon. So next time you hear someone say Purnim, get out your pepper spray. What? What does Purnim mean? Nothing. Yes.
What about the A on the end, though? Isn't that in Sanskrit? Sometimes
you can't drop a long A.
No,
you can't call Radha. You can't say, hey, Rod. You can drop a short A, but not a long A. Yes?
How should you pronounce Tulsi? Tulsi?
Tulsi? Tulsi?
What about the word Krishna?
Yeah, the word Krishna. In the word, yeah, everyone writes it or says it as if it was this, or even as if it were like, or in Latin America, it's this. Krishna. Or in certain parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, they pronounce it like this. Why not Krima? So, lo hare Krishna. So in the word Krishna, it's actually the vowel is the R. It's not K-R-I. It's actually K-R. So it's the KR is exactly like the English word, like curd, or cur, like you cur. Or imagine the English word curb. Even though it's written with a U, the vowel is not the U. Phonetically speaking, the vowel is not the U. The vowel is the R, but it's not curb. Or curs. It's not curb. It's actually curb. Or curb, or curd, the vowel is actually the R, not the U. So in Krishna, it's Krishna. Krishna.
But the N, isn't the N sound, that's where always it is. In Hindi, anyways, which is a similar alphabet, the na sound with the dot under it is like a na.
Well, they exaggerated because, I don't know, I'd go into the whole phonetics of it, just phonetic, but the idea is this. Should I do it real quickly?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No. What?
I'm just kidding. You got 15 minutes.
15 minutes? Okay, I'll do it real quickly. The Sanskrit alphabet is actually scientific. I mean, if you look at the reason the alphabet's written in a certain order is because it's actually a science of phonetics. The Sanskrit alphabet itself is actually a course in phonetics. So if you just look at, I mean, forget the vowels for now, just to be phonetics, phone, like sound.
I know what it means.
Phonetics means like the science of sound, how human beings produce sounds. So never mind the vowels for now. We'll skip the vowels. But if you look at like the Sanskrit alphabet, like ka, you know, all these things, ga, na. The idea is that all these letters like ka and cha and ta and pa, these are all called stops, because the way you make these sounds, just look at these letters, the way you make these sounds is that with your tongue, you stop the air from coming out of your mouth, then at a certain point you release it. Like if you say ka, you start out by stopping the air, ka, or cha, and then you release the air. Now, the point at which you block the air, the point in your mouth where you block the air, determines what kind of sound it is. Like if you say cup, you say make the sound. I want everybody to say cup. Then you can feel that you're blocking the air. Your tongue is touching the roof of your mouth, way back in your mouth. Cup. And so as you go ka cha ta ta pa, the point at which you block the air is moving forward in your mouth. So it's ka cha ta ta pa. So finally you get to pa, you're actually blocking the air with your lips. That's why they're called labials. It's, you know, it's the lippies. So when you say, like, do it like this, and you say pa, you're actually blocking the sound with your lips. So with ka, you're blocking the sound way back here, and then it comes forward, you say pa. So and that's how you make the different sounds. So what were we going to do here?
In Hindi version of Krishna.
Oh, so the idea is that this is your mouth. Imagine this is like, let's say these are someone's lips. This is gonna amaze and fascinate you. This is the upper lower lip. Here's someone's tongue. And then...
It looks like a burger.
It's a mouth burger. So then you block the air here. It's ka, and then cha, and then ta, and then ta, and pa. So Indian, so touching is something that kind of exaggerated sometimes. So like for the ta, you like curl your tongue, put it way back in your mouth, and you say, ka, 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 ka. I am talking like this. It's because when you make that sound is you curl your tongue and you touch your roof of your mouth way back. So you don't have to do it. I mean, you can do it a little more modern, like talk. You can say talking instead of talking. So anyway, that's...
I guess Prabhupada always pronounces Krishna.
Krishna. Yeah, Krishna. So if you think of a sh sound, and then think of an N, which is made in the same place in your mouth as a sh, Krishna. So actually, I mean, Sanskrit, the alphabet itself is a science of sound. I mean, there's a lot more to say about it, but I just gave you some few brief points. Yes?
So if you pronounce it properly, will it have more effect than if you don't pronounce it exactly?
Bhakti is more important. Krishna knows who you mean.
Yeah.
Like if someone, let's say, is calling me and they have an accent, it's like, it's not a big deal. The main thing is, like, what do you want?
I have that problem.
What's it?
Rutu Biju. Mother Rita.
Duckworth.
So, any other points?
Mark, on that point of the Srikadeva, I remember you lecturing before and saying how it's everything that's ever happened in the universe has a commemorative temple in India. And the fact that Hiranyakashipu was the ruler of the entire universe.
And he took over Indraloka.
Yet we say his kingdom was in Earth.
Well, in India...
In India.
Yeah, in India, all the pastimes they say took place over in India, even they took place on different planets. Even Prabhupada said that. They asked him, like, did this really happen? And he said, no.
What about Lord Krishna's pastimes? They really happened.
Well, yeah, on Earth, because... But that's what the Shastra says.
Right.
The scriptures say that Lord Nrsingha's pastimes took place on another planet, but Krishna's pastimes took place here. That's very clear.
So that pillar that they say is the pillar that Nrsingadev came out of in Avogala.
Yes.
That's just a commemoration.
Yeah. It's like a Pushpa Samadhi run him up. Right. So then it...
like Nrsingha Pali in Mayapur.
Yeah,
Nrsingha, they washed his hands in that lake.
Yeah, I don't know why he traveled across the galaxy just to wash his hands. I mean, I'm sure they had water up in Indraloka. But it's a nice thought.
So do they have any spiritual potency in those places?
I think it's on the whatever platform. I mean, Mayapur itself is such a holy place.
Yeah.
Maybe it just brings your consciousness to a certain place.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to remember. It's exactly as you said, a commemorative place to remember.
Right.
of course, if sadhus go there, it gets some
yes.
benefit.
Yes, Ramacharita, if he goes there, then it...
So if you're singing or something, a prayer, and if you mispronounce something, it's all right as long as the devotion's there. It's not
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't pronounce it properly.
Because sometimes I'm singing something, then I read it, and I'm like, oh, that was wrong.
No, it's a thought behind it. Christian probably thinks it's cute when you mispronounce things. Like baby.
No.
What's that?
What about
no horn?
I don't think that
that's cute. No horn, the stringer? Oh, Krishna may think it's cute.
How far should we go in trying to correctly pronounce?
Well, you should try to correctly pronounce it. I mean, it's not a big deal. You just have to learn how to pronounce it. Oh, another great one is the eeny, meeny, miny, moes. Like, that's another classic ISKCON thing. With the girls' names, eeny, meeny, like Ramacharini or Kamalini. None of those things actually exist. I'll explain it very quickly for no additional charge. Entering fully into the festival spirit here, voluntary service. That in Sanskrit, take a word like yoga. Now, if you want to say a person who has yoga or does yoga, then what you do in Sanskrit is you drop the A and you add this little ending in, so you get yogin.
But we call it yogi.
I'm getting there. But thank you for stating the obvious. So we have the word yogin, and this is the stem word, and then when you're at speaking about one person as a subject of a sentence, it becomes yogi. But the original stem word, the original is yogin. So you take this word yogin, which is masculine, and if you want to say a woman that does this, you make it feminine by adding a long I. So you add the I, and it becomes yogini. Yogini. So that's how you get the eeny, meeny, miny, mo. So there's no such thing as yogini. I mean, who knows what that would be. But it's yogini or brahmacharini, because Brahma is an old word for the Vedas, as in the first verse of the Bhagavatam, Tene Brahma Rida. And then chara means acting or behaving. So brahmacharin means one who's acting according to the Vedas. And then if you add a, and so then it becomes brahmachari. If you add a long I to make it feminine, to make it a girl, then it becomes brahmacharini. So again, the eeny, meeny, miny, moes don't exist.
Not brahmachari.
So what about kameshi?
What?
Kameshi.
Kameshi. Is that someone's name?
Yeah.
Your name? How do you like that? So, kama means desire. And then Isha means Lord, Kama, and then Ishi could mean a feminine Lord. It becomes Kameshi. It's like the Lord of Desire, one who's like completely conquered. Or so Brahmacharini, Yogini, Kamalini.
No answers, I'm just saying that the seminar is about. What's a feminine sense for Prabhu? Prabhu, no.
The word Prabhu also means feminine.
Fireball, attention. There's 5 minutes left in this seminar.
Don't shoot.
Dinner will be at 6:15 at the event tent. Thank you.
One thing is, sometimes now in ISKCON, Prabhu is like a man, Mataji's woman, but actually the word Prabhu is also feminine.
Prabhu.
There's two ways to do it. You can either say Prabhu, you know, and that changes to a V, Prabhu. But also the word Prabhu. The word Prabhu in Sanskrit means is masculine or feminine. Or neuter. You can also use it for eunuchs and everything. So. G is Hindi. So if you're into Hindi, then G away.
But this word Prabhu is also feminine. It also refers to women.
I have a burning question.
Did
Bhima really drink blood?
What?
Did Bhima drink blood? Dushasana's blood.
Yes.
Did Bhima really drink Dushasana's blood? That's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam. It is mentioned in the Mahabharata, which has some stories in the Mahabharata are real, some were added later. So that particular story, drinking Dushasana's blood, can't say it's not in the Bhagavatam.
It sounds like it's true.
What?
It
sounds like it's true. Well, I guess then it must be true. So I guess we have to stop now before the coolie SWAT team comes in here and removes us. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much, Mark.
All right.